Lloyd. I'll come give you a hand when I eat.
No need, unless you want to.
Sure, I'll do it. He followed Winfield toward the Joad camp. It was crowded now. The strange children stood close to the stew pot, so close that Ma brushed them with her elbows as she worked. Tom and Uncle John stood beside her. Ma said helplessly,
I don't know what to do. I got to feed the family. What am I going to do with these here?
The children stood stiffly and looked at her. Their faces were blank, rigid, and their eyes went mechanically from the pot to the tin plate she held. Their eyes followed the spoon from pot to plate, and when she passed the steaming plate up to Uncle John, their eyes followed it up. Uncle John dug his spoon into the stew, and the banked eyes rose up with the spoon. A piece of potato went into John's mouth, and the banked eyes were on his face, watching to see how he would react. Would it be good? Would he like it? And then Uncle John seemed to see them for the first time. He chewed slowly.
You take us here, he said to Tom. I ain't hungry.
You ain't et today, Tom said.
I know, but I got a stomach ache. I ain't hungry.
Tom said quietly, You take that plate inside the tent and you eat it.
I ain't hungry, John insisted. I'd still see him inside the tent.
Tom turned on the children.
You get, he said. Go on now, get.
The bank of eyes left the stew and rested wondering on his face.
Go on now, get. You ain't doing no good. There ain't enough for you.
Ma ladled stew into the tin plates, very little stew, and she laid the plates on the ground.
I can't send them away, she said. I don't know what to do.
Take your plates and go inside. I'll let him have what's left. Here, take a plate into Rosa Sharn. She smiled up at the children.
Look, she said, you little fellas go and get you each a flat stick, and I'll put what's left for you. And they ain't to be no fightin'.
The group broke up with a deadly, silent swiftness. Children ran to find sticks. They ran to their own tents and brought spoons. Before Ma had finished with the plates, they were back, silent and wolfish. Ma shook her head.
I don't know what to do. I can't rob the family. I got to feed the family. Ruthie, Winfield, Al...
She cried fiercely.
Take your plates. Hurry up. Get in the tent, quick.
She looked apologetically at the waiting children.
There ain't enough, she said humbly. I'm going to set this here kettle out, and you'll all get a little taste, but it ain't going to do you no good, she faltered. I can't help it. Can't keep it from you.
She lifted the pot and set it down on the ground.
Now wait. It's too hot, she said,
and she went into the tent quickly so she would not see. Her family sat on the ground, each with his plate, and outside they could hear the children digging into the pot with their sticks and their spoons and their pieces of rusty tin. A mound of children smothered the pot from sight. They did not talk, did not fight or argue, but there was a quiet intentness in all of them. A wooden fierceness. Ma turned her back so she couldn't see.
We can't do that no more, she said. We got to eat alone.
There was a sound of scraping at the kettle, and the mound of children broke, and the children walked away and left the scraped kettle on the ground. Ma looked at the empty plates.
Didn't none of you get nowhere near enough?
Pa got up and left the tent without answering. The preacher smiled to himself and lay back on the ground, hands clasped behind his head. Al got to his feet.
Gotta help a fellow with a car.
Ma gathered the plates and took them outside to wash.
Ruthie, she called. Winfield, go get me a bucket of water right off.
She handed them the bucket, and they trudged off toward the river. A strong, broad woman walked near. Her dress was streaked with dust and splotched with car oil. Her chin was held high with pride. She stood a short distance away and regarded Ma belligerently. At last she approached.
"Afternoon," she said coldly.
"Afternoon," said Ma, and she got up from her knees and pushed a box forward. "Won't you set down?"
The woman walked near.
"No, I won't set down."
Ma looked questioningly at her. "Can I help you in any way?"
The woman set her hands on her hips.
"You can hit me by minding your own children and letting mine alone."
Ma's eyes opened wide.
"I ain't done nothing," she began.
The woman scowled at her.
"My little fella come back smelling a stew. You give it to him. He told me. Don't you go a-boastin' and a-braggin' about having stew. Don't you do it. I got enough troubles thout that. Come in to me, he did, and says, 'Why'n't we have stew?'"
Her voice shook with fury. Ma moved close.
"Set down," she said. "Set down and talk a piece."
"No, I ain't gonna set down. I'm trying to feed my folks, and you come along with your stew."
"Set down," Ma said. "That was about the last stew we're gonna have till we get work. Suppose you was cooking a stew, and a bunch of little fellas stood around mooning? What'd you do? We didn't have enough, but you can't keep it when they look at you like that."
The woman's hands dropped from her hips. For a moment her eyes questioned Ma, and then she turned and walked quickly away, and she went into a tent and pulled the flaps down behind her. Ma stared after her, and then she dropped to her knees again beside the stack of tin dishes. Al hurried near.
"Tom," he called. "Ma, is Tom inside?"
Tom stuck his head out.
"What you want?"
"Come on with me,"
Al said excitedly. They walked away together.
"What's the matter with you?" Tom asked. "You'll find out. Just wait."
He led Tom to the torn-down car.
"This here's Floyd Knowles," he said.
"Yeah, I talked to him. How you?"
"Just getting her in shape," Floyd said.
Tom ran his finger over the top of the block.
"What kind of bugs is crawling on you, Al?"
"Floyd just told me. Tell him, Floyd."
Floyd said,
"Maybe I shouldn't, but yeah, I'll tell you. Fella come through, and he says there's gonna be work up north."
"Up north?"
"Yeah, place called Santa Clara Valley. Way to hell and gone up north."
"Yeah, kind of work?"
"Prune picking and pears and cannery work. Says it's pretty near ready."
"How far?" Tom demanded.
"Oh, Christ knows, maybe 200 miles.
"That's a hell of a long ways," said Tom. "How we know there's gonna be work when we get there?"
"Well, we don't know," said Floyd, "but they ain't nothing here. This fella says he got a letter from his brother, and he's on his way. He says not to tell nobody, there'll be too many. We ought to get out in the night, ought to get there and get some work lined up."
Tom studied him.
"Why we gotta sneak away?"
"Well, if everybody gets there, ain't gonna be work for nobody."
"It's a hell of a long ways," Tom said.
Floyd sounded hurt.
"I'm just giving you the tip. You don't have to take it. Your brother here helped me, and I'm giving you the tip."
"You sure there ain't no work here?"
"Look, I've been scouring around for 3 weeks all over hell, and I ain't had a bit of work, not a single handhold. If you want to look around and burn up gas looking, why, go ahead. I ain't begging you. More that goes, less chance I got."
Tom said,
"I ain't finding fault. It's just such a hell of a long ways. We kind of hoped we could get work here and rent a house to live in."
Floyd said patiently,
"I know you just got here. They stuff you gotta learn. If you'd let me tell you, it'd save you something. If you don't let me tell you, then you gotta learn the hard way. You ain't gonna settle down, 'cause there ain't no work to settle you. And your belly ain't gonna let you settle down. Now that's straight." Wished I could look around first, Tom said uneasily.
A sedan drove through the camp and pulled up at the next tent. A man in overalls and a blue shirt climbed out. Floyd called to him,
Any luck?
There ain't a hand turn of work in the whole darn country, not till cotton picking. And he went into the ragged tent.
See?
Said Floyd.
Yeah, I see. But 200 miles, Jesus.
Well, you ain't settling down no place for a while. Might's well make up your mind to that.
We better go, Al said.
Tom asked,
When is they gonna be work around here?
Well, in a month the cotton'll start. If you got plenty money, you can wait for the cotton.
Tom said,
Ma ain't gonna wanna move. She's all tarred out.
Floyd shrugged his shoulders.
I ain't a-tryin' to push you, North. Suit yourself. I just told you what I heard.
He picked the oily gasket from the running board and fitted it carefully on the block and pressed it down.
Now, he said to Al, if you want to give me a hand with that engine head.
Tom watched while they set the heavy head gently down over the head bolts and dropped it evenly.
Have to talk about it, he said.
Floyd said,
I don't want nobody but your folks to know about it, just you. And I wouldn't have told you if your brother didn't help me out here.
Tom said, Well, I sure thank you for telling us. We got to figure it out. Maybe we'll go. Al said,
By God, I think I'll go if the rest goes or not. I'll hitch there.
And leave the family?
Tom asked.
Sure. I'd come back with my jeans plumb full of jack. Why not? Ma ain't gonna like no such thing, Tom said. And Pa, he ain't gonna like it neither.
Floyd set the nuts and screwed them down as far as he could with his fingers.
Me and my wife come out with our folks, he said. Back home, we wouldn't have thought of going away. Wouldn't have thought of it. But hell, we was all up north a piece. And I come down here, and they moved on, and now God knows where they are. Been looking and asking about them ever since.
He fitted his wrench to the engine head bolts and turned them down evenly, one turn to each nut, around and around the series. Tom squatted down beside the car and squinted his eyes up the line of tents. A little stubble was beaten into the earth between the tents.
No, sir, he said. Ma ain't gonna like you going off.
Well, seems to me a lone fella got more chance of work.
Maybe. But Ma ain't gonna like it at all.
Two cars loaded with disconsolate men drove down into the camp. Floyd lifted his eyes, but he didn't ask them about their luck. Their dusty faces were sad and resistant. The sun was sinking now, and the yellow sunlight fell on the Hooverville and on the willows behind it. The children began to come out of the tents to wander about the camp. And from the tents the women came and built their little fires. The men gathered in squatting groups and talked together. A new Chevrolet coupe turned off the highway and headed down into the camp. It pulled to the center of the camp. Tom said,
Who's this? They don't belong here.
Floyd said,
I don't know. Cops, maybe.
The car door opened and a man got out and stood beside the car. His companion remained seated. Now all the squatting men looked at the newcomers and the conversation was still, and the women building their fires looked secretly at the shiny car. The children moved closer with elaborate circuitousness, edging inward in long curves. Floyd put down his wrench. Tom stood up. Al wiped his hands on his trousers. The three strolled toward the Chevrolet. The man who had got out of the car was dressed in khaki trousers and a flannel shirt. He wore a flat-brimmed Stetson hat. A sheaf of papers was held in his shirt pocket by a little fence of fountain pens and yellow pencils, and from his hip pocket protruded a notebook with metal covers. He moved to one of the groups of squatting men, and they looked up at him, suspicious and quiet. They watched him and did not move, The whites of their eyes showed beneath the irises, for they did not raise their heads to look. Tom and Al and Floyd strolled casually near. The man said, "You men want to work?" Still they looked quietly, suspiciously, and men from all over the camp moved near. One of the squatting men spoke at last.
"Sure, we want to work. Where's that's work?"
"Tulare County. Fruit's opening up. Need a lot of pickers."
Floyd spoke up.
"You doing the hiring?"
"Well, I'm contracting the land."
The men were in a compact group now. An overalled man took off his black hat and combed back his long black hair with his fingers.
"What you paying?"
he asked.
"Well, can't tell exactly yet. About 30 cents, I guess."
"Why can't you tell? You took the contract, didn't you?"
"That's true," the khaki man said. "But it's key to the price. Might be a little more, might be a little less."
Floyd stepped out ahead. He said quietly,
"I'll go, mister. You're a contractor and you got a license. You just show your license and then you give us an order to go to work and where and when and how much we'll get, and you sign that and we'll all go."
The contractor turned, scowling.
"You telling me how to run my own business?"
Floyd said,
"If we're working for you, it's our business too."
"Well, you ain't telling me what to do. I told you I need men,"
Floyd said angrily.
"You didn't say how many men, and you didn't say what you'd pay."
"God damn it, I don't know yet."
"If you don't know, you got no right to hire men."
"I got a right to run my business my own way. If you men want to sit here on your ass, okay. I'm out getting men for Tulare County. Gonna need a lot of men."
Floyd turned to the crowd of men. They were standing up now, looking quietly from one speaker to the other. Floyd said,
"Twice now I've fell for that. Maybe he needs 1,000 men. He'll get 5,000 there, and he'll pay 15 cents an hour. And you poor bastards will have to take it, 'cause you'll be hungry. If he wants to hire men, let him hire, and let him write it out. Say what he's gonna pay. Ask to see his license. He ain't allowed to contract men without a license."
The contractor turned to the Chevrolet and called,
"Joe!"
His companion looked out, and then swung the car door open and stepped out. He wore riding breeches and laced boots. A heavy pistol holster hung on a cartridge belt around his waist. On his brown shirt, a deputy sheriff's star was pinned. He walked heavily over. His face was set to a thin smile.
"What you want?"
The holster slid back and forth on his hip.
"Ever see this guy before, Joe?"
the deputy asked.
"Which one?"
"This fella."
The contractor pointed to Floyd.
"What did he do?"
The deputy smiled at Floyd.
"He's talking red, agitating trouble."
The deputy moved slowly around to see Floyd's profile, and the color slowly flowed up Floyd's face.
"You see,"
Floyd cried,
"if this guy's on the level, would he bring a cop along?"
"Ever see him before?"
the contractor insisted.
Seems like I have. Last week when that used car lot was busted into, seems like I seen this fella hanging around. Yep, I'd swear it's the same fella."
Suddenly the smile left his face. "Get in that car," he said, and he unhooked the strap that covered the butt of his automatic. Tom said,
"You got nothing on him."
The deputy swung around.
"If you'd like to go in too, you just open your trap once more. They was two fellas hanging around that lot." "I wasn't even in the state last week," Tom said. "Well, maybe you're wanted someplace else. You keep your trap shut."
The contractor turned back to the men.
"You fellas don't want to listen to these goddamn reds?"
Troublemakers. They'll get you in trouble. Now I can use all of you in Tulare County."
The men didn't answer. The deputy turned back to them.
"Might be a good idea to go," he said. The thin smile was back on his face. "Board of Health says we got to clean out this camp. And if it gets around that you got Reds out here, why, somebody might get hurt.
Be a good idea if all you fellows moved on to Tulare. They isn't a thing to do around here. That's just a friendly way of telling you. Be a bunch of guys down here, maybe with pick handles, if you ain't gone."
The contractor said, "I told you I need men. If you don't want to work, well, that's your business."
The deputy smiled. "If they don't want to work, there ain't a place for them in this county. We'll float them quick." Floyd stood stiffly beside the deputy, and Floyd's thumbs were hooked over his belt. Tom stole a look at him, and then stared at the ground.
"That's all," the contractor said. "There's men needed in Tulare County. Plenty of work."
Tom looked slowly up at Floyd's hands, and he saw the strings at the wrists standing out under the skin. Tom's own hands came up and his thumbs hooked over his belt.
"Yeah, that's all. I don't want one of you here by tomorrow morning."
The contractor stepped into the Chevrolet.
"Now, you," the deputy said to Floyd, "you get in that car."
He reached a large hand up and took hold of Floyd's left arm. Floyd spun and swung with one movement. His fist splashed into the large face, and in the same motion he was away, dodging down the line of tents. The deputy staggered, and Tom put out his foot for him to trip over. The deputy fell heavily and rolled, reaching for his gun. Floyd dodged in and out of sight down the line. The deputy fired from the ground. A woman in front of a tent screamed and then looked at a hand which had no knuckles. The fingers hung on strings against her palm, and the torn flesh was white and bloodless. Far down the line, Floyd came in sight, sprinting for the willows. The deputy, sitting on the ground, raised his gun again, and then, suddenly, from the group of men, the Reverend Casey stepped. He kicked the deputy in the neck and then stood back as the heavy man crumpled into unconsciousness. The motor of the Chevrolet roared and it streaked away, churning the dust. It mounted to the highway and shot away. In front of her tent, the woman still looked at her shattered hand. Little droplets of blood began to ooze from the wound, and a chuckling hysteria began in her throat, a whining laugh that grew louder and higher with each breath. The deputy lay on his side, his mouth open against the dust. Tom picked up his automatic, pulled out the magazine, and threw it into the brush, and he ejected the live shell from the chamber.
"Fella like that ain't got no right to a gun," he said, and he dropped the automatic to the ground.
A crowd had collected around the woman with the broken hand, and her hysteria increased. A screaming quality came into her laughter. Casey moved close to Tom.
"You got to get out," he said. "You go down in the willows and wait. He didn't see me kick him, but he seen you stick out your foot."
"I don't want to go," Tom said. Casey put his head close. He whispered,
"They'll fingerprint you. You broke parole. They'll send you back."
Tom drew in his breath quietly. "Jesus, I forgot."
"Go quick," Casey said, "'fore he comes to."
"Like to have his gun," Tom said.
"Nope, leave it. If it's all right to come back, I'll give you four high whistles."
Tom strolled away casually, but as soon as he was away from the group, he hurried his steps, and he disappeared among the willows that lined the river. Al stepped over to the fallen deputy.
"Jesus,"
he said admiringly. "You sure flagged him down." The crowd of men had continued to stare at the unconscious man. And now in the great distance, a siren screamed up the scale and dropped, and it screamed again, nearer this time. Instantly, the men were nervous. They shifted their feet for a moment, and then they moved away, each one to his own tent. Only Al and the preacher remained. Casey turned to Al.
"Get out," he said. "Go on. Get out to the tent. You don't know nothing."
"Here? How about you?"
Casey grinned at him.
"Somebody got to take the blame. I got no kids. They'll just put me in jail, and I ain't doing nothing but set around."
Al said, "Ain't no reason for..."
"Go on now,"
Casey said sharply.
"You get out of this."
Al bristled.
"I ain't taking orders,"
Casey said softly.
"If you mess in this, your whole family, all your folks, gonna get in trouble. I don't care about you, but your ma and your pa, they'll get in trouble. Maybe they'll send Tom back to McAllister."
Al considered it for a moment.
"Okay," he said.
"I think you're a damn fool, though."
"Sure," said Casey. "Why not?"
The siren screamed again and again, and always it came closer. Casey knelt beside the deputy and turned him over. The man groaned and fluttered his eyes, and he tried to see. Casey wiped the dust off his lips. The families were in the tents now, and the flaps were down, and the setting sun made the air red and the gray tents bronze. Tires squealed on the highway, and an open car came swiftly into the camp. Four men, armed with rifles, piled out. Casey stood up and walked to them.
"What the hell's going on here?"
Casey said,
"I knocked out your man there."
One of the armed men went to the deputy. He was conscious now, trying weakly to sit up.
"Now what happened here?"
"Well," Casey said, "he got tough, and I hit him, and he started shooting. Hit a woman down the line, so I hit him again."
"Well, what'd you do in the first place?"
"I talked back," said Casey. "Get in that car."
"Sure,"
said Casey, and he climbed into the back seat and sat down. Two men helped the hurt deputy to his feet. He felt his neck gingerly. Casey said,
"There's a woman down the road like to bleed to death from his bad shooting." "We'll see about that later. Mike, is this the fella that hit you?"
The dazed man stared sickly at Casey.
"Don't look like him."
"It was me, all right," Casey said. "You got smart with the wrong fella."
Mike shook his head slowly.
"You don't look like the right fella to me. By God, I'm gonna be sick,"
Casey said.
"I'll go without no trouble. You better see how bad that woman's hurt."
"Where's she?"
"That tent over there."
The leader of the deputies walked to the tent, rifle in hand. He spoke through the tent walls and then went inside. In a moment he came out and walked back. And he said, a little proudly,
"Jesus, what a mess a 45 does make. They got a tourniquet on. We'll send a doctor out."
Two deputies sat on either side of Casey. The leader sounded his horn. There was no movement in the camp. The flaps were down tight, and the people in their tents. The engine started, and the car swung around and pulled out of the camp. Between his guards, Casey sat proudly, his head up and the stringy muscles of his neck prominent. On his lips, there was a faint smile, and on his face, a curious look of conquest. When the deputies had gone, the people came out of the tents. The sun was down now, and the gentle blue evening light was in the camp. To the east, the mountains were still yellow with sunlight. The women went back to the fires that had died. The men collected to squat together and to talk softly. Al crawled from under the Jode tarpaulin and walked toward the willows to whistle for Tom. Ma came out and built her little fire of twigs.
"Pa," she said, "we ain't gonna have much. We et so late."
Pa and Uncle John stuck close to the camp, watching Ma peeling potatoes and slicing them raw into a frying pan of deep grease. Pa said,
Now what the hell made the preacher do that?
Ruthie and Winfield crept close and crouched down to hear the talk. Uncle John scratched the earth deeply with a long, rusty nail.
He knowed about sin. I asked him about sin, and he told me. But I don't know if he's right. He says a fella's sinned if he thinks he's sinned.
Uncle John's eyes were tired and sad.
I've been secret all my days, he said. I done things I never told about.
Ma turned from the fire. Don't go tellin', John, she said. Tell him to God. Don't go burdenin' other people with your sins. That ain't decent.
They're a-eatin' on me, said John.
Well, don't tell him. Go down the river and stick your head under and whisper him in the stream. Pa nodded his head slowly at Ma's words.
She's right, he said. It gives a fella relief to tell, but it just spreads out his sin.
Uncle John looked up to the sun-gold mountains, and the mountains were reflected in his eyes.
I wished I could run it down, he said, but I can't. She's a-biting in my guts.
Behind him, Rose of Sharon moved dizzily out of the tent.
Where's Connie? She asked irritably. I ain't seen Connie for a long time. Where'd he go?
I ain't seen him, said Ma. If I see him, I'll tell him you want him.
I ain't feeling good, said Rose of Sharon. Connie shouldn't have left me.
Ma looked up to the girl's swollen face. You've been a-crying, she said. The tears started freshly in Rose of Sharon's eyes. Ma went on firmly. You get a holt on yourself. There's a lot of us here. You get a holt on yourself. Come here now and peel some potatoes. You're feeling sorry for yourself. The girl started to go back in the tent. She tried to avoid Ma's stern eyes, but they compelled her, and she came slowly toward the fire.
He shouldn't have went away, she said,
but the tears were gone.
You got to work, Ma said. Set in the tent, and you'll get feeling sorry about yourself. I ain't had time to take you in hand. I will now. You take this here knife and get to them potatoes.
The girl knelt down and obeyed. She said fiercely,
Wait till I see him. I'll tell him.
Ma smiled slowly. He might smack you. You got it coming, with whining around and candying yourself. If he smacks some sense in you, I'll bless him. The girl's eyes blazed with resentment, but she was silent. Uncle John pushed his rusty nail deep into the ground with his broad thumb.
I got to tell, he said.
Pa said,
Well then, goddammit, who'd you kill?
Uncle John dug with his thumb into the watch pocket of his blue jeans and scooped out a folded, dirty bill. He spread it out and showed it.
$5,
he said.
Stealer?
Pa asked.
Nope. I had her. Kept her out. She was yourn, wasn't she? Yep, but I didn't have no right to keep her out.
I don't see much sin in that, Ma said. It's yourn.
Uncle John said slowly,
It ain't only the keeping her out. I kept her out to get drunk. I knowed there was gonna come a time when I got to get drunk. When I'd get to hurtin' inside, so I got to get drunk. Figured time wasn't yet. And then the preacher went and give himself up to save Tom.
Pa nodded his head up and down and cocked his head to hear. Ruthie moved closer, like a puppy, crawling on her elbows, and Winfield followed her. Rose of Sharon dug at a deep eye in a potato with the point of her knife. The evening light deepened and became more blue. Ma said in a sharp, matter-of-fact tone,
I don't see why him saving Tom got to get you drunk.
John said sadly,
Can't say her. I feel awful. He done her so easy. Just stepped up there and says, I done her.
and they took him away, and I'm a-gonna get drunk.
Pa still nodded his head.
I don't see why you got to tell, he said. If it was me, I'd just go off and get drunk if I had to. Come a time when I could have did something and took the big sin off my soul, Uncle John said sadly, and I slipped up. I didn't jump on her, and she got away. Looky, he said, you got the money. Give me $2.
Pa reached reluctantly into his pocket and brought out the leather pouch.
You ain't gonna need no $7 to get drunk. You don't need to drink champagne water.
Uncle John held out his bill.
You take this here and give me $2. I can get good and drunk for $2. I don't want no sin of waste on me. I'll spend whatever I got. I always do.
Pa took the dirty bill and gave Uncle John $2 silver.
There you are, he said. A fella gotta do what he gotta do. Nobody don't know enough to tell him.
Uncle John took the coins.
You ain't gonna be mad. You know I got to. Christ, yes, said Pa. You know what you gotta do. I wouldn't be able to get through this night no other way, he said. He turned to Ma. You ain't gonna hold her over me?
Ma didn't look up.
No, she said softly. No, you go along.
He stood up and walked forlornly away in the evening. He walked up to the concrete highway and across the pavement to the grocery store. In front of the screen door, he took off his hat, dropped it into the dust, and ground it with his heel in self-abasement. Then he left his black hat there, broken and dirty. He entered the store and walked to the shelves where the whiskey bottles stood behind wire netting. Pa and Ma and the children watched Uncle John move away. Rose of Sharon kept her eyes resentfully on the potatoes.
Poor John, Ma said. I wondered if it would have done any good if...
No,
I guess not. I never seen a man so drove.
Ruthie turned on her side in the dust. She put her head close to Winfield's head and pulled his ear against her mouth. She whispered,
I'm a-gonna get drunk.
Winfield snorted and pinched his mouth tight. The two children crawled away, holding their breath, their faces purple with the pressure of their giggles. They crawled around the tent, leaped up and ran squealing away from the tent. They ran to the willows, and once concealed, they shrieked with laughter. Ruthie crossed her eyes and loosened her joints. She staggered about, tripping loosely, with her tongue hanging out.
I'm drunk, she said. Look, Winfield cried. Look at me. Here's me, and I'm Uncle John.
He flapped his arms and puffed. He whirled until he was dizzy.
No, said Ruthie. Here's the way. Here's the way. I'm Uncle John. I'm awful drunk.
Al and Tom walked quietly through the willows, and they came on the children, staggering crazily about. The dusk was thick now. Tom stopped and peered.
Ain't that Ruthie and Winfield? What the hell's the matter with them?
They walked nearer.
You crazy? Tom asked.
The children stopped, embarrassed.
We was just playing, Ruthie said.
It's a crazy way to play, said Al.
Ruthie said pertly,
It ain't no crazier than a lot of things.
Al walked on. He said to Tom,
Ruthie's working up a kick in the pants. She been working it up a long time, about due for it.
Ruthie mushed her face at his back, pulled out her mouth with her forefingers, slobbered her tongue at him, outraged him in every way she knew. But Al did not turn back to look at her. She looked at Winfield again to start the game, but it had been spoiled. They both knew it.
Let's go down the water and duck our heads, Winfield suggested.
They walked down through the willows, and they were angry at Al. Al and Tom went quietly in the dusk. Tom said,
Casey shouldn't have did it. I might have knew, though. He was talking how he ain't done nothing for us. He's a funny fella, Al. All the time thinking.
Comes from being a preacher, Al said. They get all messed up with stuff.
Where you suppose Connie was a-going?
Going to take a crap, I guess.
Well, he was going a hell of a long way.
They walked among the tents, keeping close to the walls. At Floyd's tent, a soft hail stopped them. They came near to the tent flap and squatted down. Floyd raised the canvas a little.
You getting out?
Tom said,
I don't know. Think we better?
Floyd laughed sourly.
You heard what that bull said. They'll burn you out if you don't. If you think that guy's gonna take a beating without getting back, you're nuts. The pool room boys will be down here tonight to burn us out.
Guess we better get then, Tom said. Where are you going?
Why, up north, like I said.
Al said, look, a fella told me about a government camp near here. Where's it at?
Oh, I think that's full up.
Well, where's it at?
Go south on 99 about 12-14 miles and turn east to Weed Patch. It's right near there, but I think she's full up.
Fella says it's nice, Al said.
Sure, she's nice. Treats you like a man instead of a dog. Ain't no cops there, but she's full up.
Tom said,
what I can't understand's why that cop was so mean. Seemed like he was aiming for trouble. Seemed like he's poking a fella to make trouble.
Floyd said,
I don't know about here, but up north, I knowed one of them fellas, and he was a nice fella. He told me up there the deputy's got to take guys in. Sheriff gets 75 cents a day for each prisoner, and he feeds them for a quarter. If he ain't got prisoners, he don't make no profit. This fella says he didn't pick up nobody for a week, and the sheriff told him he better bring in guys or give up his button. This fella today sure looks like he's out to make a pinch one way or another.
We got to get on, said Tom. So long, Floyd.
So long. Probably see you. Hope so.
Goodbye, said Al. They walked through the dark gray camp to the Jode tent. The frying pan of potatoes was hissing and spitting over the fire. Mom moved the thick slices about with a spoon. Pa sat nearby, hugging his knees. Rose of Sharon was sitting under the tarpaulin.
It's Tom, Ma cried. Thank God.
We gotta get out of here, said Tom.
What's the matter now?
Well, Floyd says they'll burn the camp tonight.
What the hell for?
Pa asked.
We ain't done nothing.
Nothing except beat up a cop, said Tom.
Well, we never done it.
From what that cop said, they want to push us along.
Rose of Sharon demanded,
You seen Connie?
Yeah, said Al. Way to hell and gone up the river. He's going south.
Was he going away?
I don't know.
Ma turned on the girl.
Rose of Sharon, you've been talking and acting funny. What did Connie say to you?
Rose of Sharon said sullenly,
Said it would have been a good thing if he'd stayed home and studied up tractors.
They were very quiet. Rose of Sharon looked at the fire, and her eyes glistened in the firelight. The potatoes hissed sharply in the frying pan. The girl sniffled and wiped her nose with the back of her hand. Pa said,
Connie wasn't no good. I seen that a long time. Didn't have no guts, just too big for his overalls.
Rose of Sharon got up and went into the tent. She lay down on the mattress and rolled over on her stomach and buried her head in her crossed arms.
Wouldn't do no good to catch him, I guess, Al said.
Pa replied,
Nope. If he ain't no good, we don't want him.
Ma looked into the tent, where Rose of Sharon lay on her mattress. Ma said,
Shh, don't say that.
Well, he ain't no good, Pa insisted. All the time of saying what he's a-gonna do, never doing nothing. I didn't want to say nothing while he's here, but now he's run out, shh,
Ma said softly.
Why, for Christ's sake, why do I got to shish? He run out, didn't he?
Ma turned over the potatoes with her spoon, and the grease boiled and spat. She fed twigs to the fire, and the flames laced up and lighted the tent. Ma said,
Rosa Sharn gonna have a little fella, and that baby is half Connie. It ain't good for a baby to grow up with folks a-saying his pa ain't no good.
Better than lying about it, said Pa.
No, it ain't, Ma interrupted. Make out like he's dead. You wouldn't say no bad things about Connie if he's dead.
Tom broke in.
Hey, what is this? We ain't sure Connie's gone for good. We got no time for talking. We gotta eat and get on our way.
On our way? We just come here.
Ma peered at him through the fire-lighted darkness. He explained carefully,
They gonna burn the camp tonight, Ma. Now you know I ain't got it in me to stand by and see our stuff burn up. Nor Pa ain't got it in him, nor Uncle John. We'd come up a-fightin', and I just can't afford to be took in and mugged. I nearly got it today, if the preacher hadn't jumped in.
Ma had been turning the frying potatoes in the hot grease. Now she took her decision.
Come on, she cried. Let's eat this stuff. We got to go, quick.
She set out the tin plates. Pa said,
How about John?
Where is Uncle John?
Tom asked. Ma and Pa were silent for a moment, and then Pa said,
He went to get drunk.
Jesus, Tom said. What a time he picked out. Where'd he go?
I don't know, said Pa.
Tom stood up.
Look, he said, you all eat and get the stuff loaded. I'll go look for Uncle John. He'd have went to the store across the road.
Tom walked quickly away. The little cooking fires burned in front of the tents and the shacks, and the light fell on the faces of ragged men and women, on crouched children. In a few tents, the light of kerosene lamps shone through the canvas and placed shadows of people hugely on the cloth. Tom walked up the dusty road and crossed the concrete highway to the little grocery store. He stood in front of the screen door and looked in. The proprietor, a little gray man with an unkempt mustache and watery eyes, leaned on the counter reading a newspaper. His thin arms were bare, and he wore a long white apron. Heaped around and in back of him were mounds, pyramids, walls of canned goods. He looked up when Tom came in, and his eyes narrowed as though he aimed a shotgun.
Good evening, he said. Run out of something?
Run out of my uncle, said Tom, or he run out or something.
The gray man looked puzzled and worried at the same time. He touched the tip of his nose tenderly and waggled it around to stop an itch.
Seems like you people always lost somebody, he said. 10 times a day or more, somebody comes in here and says, If you see a man named so-and-so and looks like so-and-so, will you tell him we went up north? Something like that all the time.
Tom laughed.
Well, if you see a young snot-nose named Connie, looks a little bit like a coyote, tell him to go to hell. We went south, but he ain't the fella I'm looking for. Did a fella about 60 years old, black pants, sort of grayish hair, come in here and get some whiskey?
The eyes of the gray man brightened.
Now, he sure did. I never seen anything like it. He stood out front, and he dropped his hat and stepped on it. Here, I got his hat here.
He brought the dusty, broken hat from under the counter. Tom took it from him.
That's him, all right.
Well, sir, he got a couple pints of whiskey, and he didn't say a thing. He pulled the cork and tipped up the bottle. I ain't got a license to drink here. I says, look, you can't drink here. You got to go outside. Well, sir, he just stepped outside the door, and I bet he didn't tilt up that pint more'n 4 times till it was empty. He throwed it away, and he leaned in the door, eyes kind of dull. He says, Thank you, sir,
and he went on. I never seen no drinking like that in my life.
Went on. Which way? I gotta get him.
Well, it so happens I can tell you. I never seen such drinking, so I looked out after him. He went north, and then a car come along and lighted him up, and he went down the bank. Legs was beginning to buckle a little. He got the other pint open already. He won't be far, not the way he was going.
Tom said, thank you. I gotta find him.
You wanna take his hat?
Yeah, yeah. He'll need it. Well, thank you.
What's the matter with him?
The gray man asked.
He wasn't taking pleasure in his drink.
Oh, he's kinda moody. Well, good night. And if you see that squirt Connie, tell him we've went south.
I got so many people to look out for and tell stuff to, I can't ever remember 'em all.
Don't put yourself out too much, Tom said.
He went out the screen door carrying Uncle John's dusty black hat. He crossed the concrete road and walked along the edge of it. Below him in the sunken field the Hooverville lay. The little fires flickered and the lanterns shone through the tents. Somewhere in the camp a guitar sounded, slow chords, struck without any sequence, practice chords. Tom stopped and listened, and then he moved slowly along the side of the road, and every few steps he stopped to listen again. He had gone a quarter of a mile before he heard what he listened for. Down below the embankment the sound of a thick, tuneless voice, singing drably. Tom cocked his head the better to hear, and the dull voice sang,
I've given my heart to Jesus, so Jesus take me home. I give my soul to Jesus, so Jesus is my home.
The song trailed off to a murmur and then stopped. Tom hurried down from the embankment toward the song. After a while he stopped and listened again, and the voice was close this time, the same slow, tuneless singing.
On the night that Maggie died, she called me to her side and gave to me them old red flannel drawers that Maggie wore. They was baggy at the knees.
Tom moved cautiously forward. He saw the black form sitting on the ground, and he stole near and sat down. Uncle John tilted the pint, and the liquor gurgled out of the neck of the bottle. Tom said quietly,
Hey, wait. Where do I come in?
Uncle John turned his head.
Who you?
You forgot me already? You had four drinks to my one.
No, Tom, don't try fool me. I'm all alone here. You ain't been here.
Well, I'm sure here now. How about giving me a snort?
Uncle John raised the pint again, and the whiskey gurgled. He shook the bottle. It was empty.
No more, he said. Want to die so bad. Want to die awful. Die a little bit. Got to. Like sleeping. Die a little bit. So tired. Tired. Maybe. Don't wake up no more.
His voice crooned off.
Gonna wear a crown. A golden crown.
Tom said,
Listen here to me, Uncle John. We're gonna move on. You come along and you can go right to sleep on the load.
John shook his head.
No, go on. Ain't going. Gonna rest here. No good going back. No good to nobody. Just a dragging my sins like dirty drawers amongst nice folks. Nope, ain't going.
Come on. We can't go less you go.
Go right along. I ain't no good. I ain't no good. Just dragging my sins dirty in everybody.
You got no more sin in anybody else.
John put his head close and he winked one eye wisely. Tom could see his face dimly in the starlight.
"Nobody don't know my sins. Nobody but Jesus. He knows."
Tom got down on his knees. He put his hand on Uncle John's forehead, and it was hot and dry. John brushed his hand away clumsily. "Come on," Tom pleaded. "Come on now, Uncle John."
"Ain't gonna go. Just tired. Gonna rest right here. Right here."
Tom was very close. He put his fist against the point of Uncle John's chin. He made a small practice arc twice for distance, and then, with his shoulder in the swing, he hit the chin a delicate, perfect blow. John's chin snapped up, and he fell backwards and tried to sit up again. But Tom was kneeling over him, and as John got one elbow up, Tom hit him again. Uncle John lay still on the ground. Tom stood up, and bending, he lifted the loose, sagging body and boosted it over his shoulder. He staggered under the loose weight. John's hanging hands tapped him on the back as he went, slowly, puffing up the bank to the highway. Once a car came by and lighted him with a limp man over his shoulder. The car slowed for a moment and then roared away. Tom was panting when he came back to the Hooverville, down from the road and to the Jode truck. John was coming too. He struggled weakly. Tom set him gently down on the ground. Camp had been broken while he was gone. Al passed the bundles up on the truck. The tarpaulin lay ready to bind over the load. Al said, "He sure got a quick start." Tom apologized. "I had to hit him a little to make him come. Poor fella."
"Didn't hurt him?"
Ma asked.
"Don't think so. He's a-coming out of it."
Uncle John was weakly sick on the ground. His spasms of vomiting came in little gasps. Ma said, "I left a plate of potatoes for you, Tom." Tom chuckled.
"I ain't just in the mood right now."
Pa called,
"All right, Al, sling up the tarp."
The truck was loaded and ready. Uncle John had gone to sleep. Tom and Al boosted and pulled him up the load, while Winfield made a vomiting noise behind the truck, and Ruthie plugged her mouth with her hand to keep from squealing.
"All ready,"
Pa said. Tom asked,
"Where's Rosa Sharn?"
"Over there," said Ma.
"Come on, Rosa Sharn, we're a-going."
The girl sat still, her chin sunk on her breast. Tom walked over to her.
"Come on," he said.
"I ain't a-going."
She did not raise her head.
"You got to go."
"I want Connie. I ain't a-going till he comes back."
Three cars pulled out of the camp, up the road to the highway, old cars loaded with the camps and the people. They clanked up to the highway and rolled away, their dim lights glancing along the road. Tom said,
"Connie'll find us. I left word up at the store where he'd be. He'll find us."
Ma came up and stood beside him.
"Come on, Rosa Sharn. Come on, honey,"
she said gently.
"I want to wait."
"We can't wait."
Ma leaned down and took the girl by the arm and helped her to her feet.
"He'll find us," Tom said. "Don't you worry. He'll find us."
They walked on either side of the girl.
"Maybe he went to get them books to study up," said Rose of Sharon. "Maybe he was a-gonna surprise us."
Ma said, "Maybe that's just what he done."
They led her to the truck and helped her up on top of the load, and she crawled under the tarpaulin and disappeared into the dark cave. Now the bearded man from the weed shack came timidly to the truck. He waited about, his hands clutched behind his back.
"You gonna leave any stuff a fella could use?"
he asked at last.
Pa said, "Can't think of nothing. We ain't got nothing to leave." Tom asked, "Ain't you getting out?" For a long time, the beard